Are we ready to go?
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe we have all the directors present.
Are we ready to go? I'm sorry.
Sure, why not?
Yes, all the directors are present.
Okay. All right, let's call the meeting to order then. So we're past item number one. Can we have a roll call, please, Laura? Or Daniel, whoever's going to do that.
I can go ahead and do that. Director Cody?
Here.
Director Gibson?
Here.
Director Zimmer?
Here.
Chairperson Ohilski?
Present.
Everybody's here.
Okay, do we have any board member comments for item number three? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to item number four, the special presentation. So from the Los Osos Groundwater Basin Management Committee, which is us. So Daniel?
Yeah, so we actually don't have a special presentation this meeting, so we can move on to item number five.
Okay, the consent agenda. Does anybody have any questions about the consent agenda? Or does anybody want to pull any of the items?
This is Mark. You know, there's one thing, our budget. I don't know if we need to pull that out or if it's more or less just a comment on one of the items in the budget. And that's our future project to review the recycled water for the basin. I think there's been some development with the county that they have some funding. I just want to make sure that we're not duplicating the work there. I think there's some things that the basin management committee can do that would be helpful for our purposes outside of what the county's doing, but I just want to note to Dan to just make sure that we're just not double overlapping those efforts and we're actually getting some substance beneficial to the BMC from our project that we're funding through the BMC.
Yeah, I don't think we need to pull the item because you've said what you wanted to say, so. Okay. Okay, so Laura, can we go to public comment on the consent agenda, please?
If you'd like to make a public comment and you're on your phone, please dial *9. And if you're on your computer, please raise your hand. There's no public comment at this time.
Okay, we'll close public comment and bring it back for a motion by the committee.
I'll move approval of consent. Yeah, S&T seconds that.
Okay. Let's take a roll call vote, Daniel, please.
Sure. Director Cody?
Approve.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Zimmer?
Yes.
Chair Ohilski?
Yes.
Okay. Motion passes.
Okay. All right, now we're at item number six, public comment for items not appearing on the agenda. And I would like to make it crystal clear if anybody wants to comment, it's for items not on the agenda. And we do have three action items later. Okay, so Laura, can you go to that, please?
If you'd like to make a public comment, please raise your hand. All right, Jeff, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jeff Edwards, and I have several comments and a couple of questions. For starters, I'd like to update you all regarding the Title 19 amendments. And they're now calling this the Los Osos Water Offset Study. Unfortunately, there was only one respondent to the RFP that went out. And the county's waiting for the final approval of a state grant before they can proceed and sign the contract with the consultant. They have a website they've set up, and there will be a timeline posted probably early next week. My second comment is we heard on numerous occasions the sustainability group, quote, sustainability group, mention that we have 16,000 people in Los Osos. That's our population. And I suspect some of you now have looked at the U.S. Census for 2020. And the number, the real number, is 14,465. So a substantial departure from 16,000 people. I would submit to you that it calls into question virtually all of the numbers advanced by the sustainability group. I think they need to get a mathematician to go along with their lawyer and hydrologist. And on the same note, you know, these guys are opposing all of the ADUs, but they don't have any objection to all of the illegally occupied RVs, trailers, and Airstreams in town that have no offsets. And we know the ADUs would have offsets. Likewise, the sustainability group doesn't have any problem with the addition of bedrooms and bathrooms to existing homes, which also don't have any offsets. So their message is, let's call it skewed. Additionally, I'd like to mention the American Rescue Plan Act and the decision or action the Board of Supervisors took on August 10th. They approved $350,000 out of $15 million to hook up the schools. Well, we've had this discussion. We don't need to hook up the schools. So let's take that $350,000, and this is a focus to Gibson. Let's take that $350,000 and put it towards something that would help sink the operations of the wastewater project and the basin management committee and the basin management plan. As to my questions, we know that S&T Mutual hired Cleith Harris Group for a nitrate study, and it'd be nice to know if that's completed and what the results are. And then lastly, the Cleith Harris Group has also been commissioned to evaluate our deployment of recycled water and reinvent the wheel there, presumably. And what's the status, or when can we expect those results? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, Keith, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. My name is Keith Weimer. One of the tasks given to staff in July, as I recall, was to find out how much it would cost to provide transcripts of meetings. Was this done? And if so, what is the cost? And when would you be voting on this upgrade to the minutes? I'd like to know too, and this overlaps some of what Jeff said, when the evaluation of the metrics and recycled water use by Cleith Harris will be completed and presented. It seems like the BMC is running out of time to complete those tasks, which were budgeted for this year. Also, I was wondering when the funding committee will be making a presentation. And I'd like to be sure two funding options are considered and presented. A basin-wide funding mechanism that spreads basin management cost equitably, including the cost for BMC operations, the monitoring program, conservation and recycled water programs, as proposed in the basin plan. This plan is supposed to reduce costs to home and business owners within the wastewater service area by reducing their costs for the wastewater project. And number two, I'd like to see an option that is the same type of basin-wide equitable plan that assumes that all infrastructure programs are implemented for the current population and none is paid for by new development. Staff agrees with the LOSG that zoning intrusion threatens basin sustainability, and I think that possibly the only feasible way to stop and reverse seawater intrusion in Zone E is by injection using water resources from within the basin, supplied in large part from completion of the remaining infrastructure programs. Please ensure the funding committee evaluates these two options. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Lindy, you just have to unmute yourself.
There I go. Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I have three questions. When will the discussion about metering the 500 private wells for usage come into a study or a evaluation? Other communities are going that direction, because that's the only way that you will know how much water is going out. If you drive back into the areas that have the private wells, you will see the lush landscape that they enjoy. So it's almost like a split town. You leave from one side of town, go over to where they have private wells, and man, they're using their water happily. Number two, when will the discussion about upping the reuse of the recycled water in an ag exchange program that actually does something to stop taking water out of the basin, when we've got a resource right there? And number three, I wonder if you've addressed, and I can't remember, I'm sorry, the bills that now opened up jamming in more housing into existing communities. It's a state law, a couple of, I think, laws that went in, because there is no address. I saw nothing addressing the resources needed to be able to approve and allow density, that huge density. That's all. Thank you.
All right, Patrick, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Jeff Edwards needs to become educated. Good afternoon. My name is Patrick McGibney. I was truly hoping to make some positive comments, but instead I'm commenting in dismay at the lack of actions this committee has taken to manage our basin in a sustainable way. You have not taken any immediate, bold, decisive actions as you are required to do in the basin management plan. You have not gathered any hard data to guide you in discussions and to formulate a sustainable yield that will not promote further seawater water intrusion as required in stipulated judgment. You have not devised a plan that would adequately and equitably fund the projects needed, also as required in the basin plan. You are lacking actions that would assure our basin is protected in a sustainable way for the present and possible future populations. Instead, you remain silent when the county uses their Title 19 agenda to rationalize more growth. You remain silent also when the community saves water, conserves its water to help save the basin, but the county uses it instead to allow more building. When are you going to take actions that will stabilize our water basin and stop or reverse seawater intrusion? It's been over 6 years, and your management has, all we have seen is a manipulation of data based on modeling to show slight improvements. Your spring data report of chloride readings and your recalculation of precipitation are good examples. Mr. Edwards and Supervisor Gibson have cautioned against using LA-10 as a reliable monitoring well, though they probably like it now because it shows slight improvements. But regardless of its showing, up or down, it is unreliable and shouldn't be used. And LA-31 has never been below 738 milligrams per liter of chloride and has been as high as 1,100. And a few years ago, it was at 940. But in April, it's suddenly down to 161. This happened because of a sampling that was taken was results in the upper aquifer influence due to reduced pumping. This was an anomaly and shouldn't have been used. And as far as Zone E goes, it too has higher chloride readings. Most of the other monitoring wells show increased chloride yet above and of LA-10, you will show chloride levels dropping. Precipitation is another issue. Who goes back 60 years to extract rain totals to predict the future rain amounts that will be coming after we're battling climate change and mega droughts? This is crazy and disingenuous. I hope the purveyors will question some of these findings that are based on inaccurate data and historical data. Thank you.
There's no further public comment at this time.
Thank you, Laura. I think, Daniel, the questions that were asked, we need to prepare some responses for that. I don't know if there's anything you just want to respond to quickly.
Yeah, I can hit a couple of these items, Marshall. The question about transcripts for meetings, that was discussed at a staff level following our July meeting. All the input received from the staff, from the parties, was that there was not staff level support for the costs that would be associated with developing full transcripts for the meetings. And the additional input was that any low-cost options that had been employed by parties for other projects had proved unreliable and presented some of the very similar issues that we've had in the past trying to characterize everything that someone says in a statement. There was a question about the metric update task. The response to that is that the update of the metrics is currently on hold pending the sustainable yield estimate update, as any changes and or modifications to the sustainable yield methodology may impact or inform the update to the metrics. And so we're taking some of these tasks sequentially. That additionally applies to the recycled water beneficial use study. Modifications to the sustainable yield estimate methodology could have implications to the recycled water study and or the calculation of the benefit through ag exchange, to address Lindy's question. Metering of private wells, that's an initiative that was part of the implementation plan that was used as the guidance or the framework for developing the calendar year 2021 budget. And so as we enter into the planning cycle for calendar year 2022, that along with all the other initiatives that the BMC has identified for possible implementation or evaluation will be reconsidered. And the funding subcommittee presentation is forthcoming. There are ongoing efforts to summarize the available funding options for the BMC and the sort of the constraints and benefits of those different funding options. And so it's anticipated that that'll come forth before the end of the year. And I think those were the main ones that I can address right now.
Okay, and I would like to just add one thing about the metering the ag wells. The Basin Management Committee has taken a position on that numerous times, but we have no authority or power to do that. That's within the county, and the county has chosen to require metering of new wells, but not existing ag wells. So that's where that stands at this point. Okay, Daniel, we'll move on to, there is no executive director's report. We'll move on to action items. First of all, item 8A, the draft spring 2021 lower aquifer groundwater basin monitoring results. The recommendation is to receive the update on early findings for the spring 2021 lower aquifer groundwater monitoring results. So, Daniel.
Thank you, Marshall. We're going to transition screen sharing here, so bear with us a second.
Oh, a fun screen transfer? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so item 8A, presentation of the draft spring 2021 lower aquifer groundwater basin monitoring results. We have these results available for the BMC's review. These are still characterized as draft, but will be finalized when they get incorporated into the calendar year 2021 annual report. And then additionally included with the spring results is updated water level and chloride metric calculations based off of the spring water level and chloride data that was collected. Final results and then additionally water levels from the first water and upper aquifer monitoring will be provided in the annual report. So for sharing today. As part of the meeting presentation, I've included the updated water level and chloride metrics relative to measurements and, from the previous fall monitoring. There is a minor improvement in both of these metrics and a reduction of the chloride metric and a increase in the water level metric. However, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that really the importance of these metrics and the value that we get from these metrics is our evaluation of the longer term trends. There are, we will continue to see fluctuations in these metrics related to a number of factors, and including, hydrologic patterns, but also pumping and other considerations. But overall, you know, we want to see the water level metric to continue to increase and the chloride metric to decrease. Another thing for consideration is, what was the envisioned movement of these metrics over time? And so I've included an additional slide in the presentation that shows how the BMC anticipated these metrics would change over time as the basin plan was implemented. And so this graph shows in the dashed line kind of the anticipated movement of these metrics as the Broderson Mound builds and creates that increased pressure in the lower aquifer, which is one of the key strategies in helping push seawater intrusion back towards the bay, and also did increase the groundwater elevation in the water level metric wells. And so that concludes my presentation on the draft spring lower aquifer groundwater monitoring results.
Thank you, Daniel. Does anybody have any questions before we go to public comment?
Yeah, I have a question. You know, I had similar to our public comment, the LA 31 results down there. Are those included in this, the chloride metric, or was that taken out? Because it's obviously a significant difference there. And just looking at the two notes under the station ID column, I think they are saying, I'm comparing it to the LA 10, which is just above it. I think we're saying the same thing, but the it's written differently. So we may need to clean that up just so it's saying, because I think they're both influenced by the borehole leakage. So Dan, did you address that comment from public comment? Because I didn't hear it. I didn't catch it if you did. But I have that same comment.
Yeah, I did not address that comment. The LA 31 well, to my knowledge, is not part of the chloride metric. And so to address that component of the comment, it is not included in the graph that we're, well, showing, was showing, and I will move back to in this graph. But, you know, as noted, there is influence both in that well and the LA 10 well from either borehole leakage or the rate at which those wells are pumped. That's something unfortunately we deal with many of the wells within the basin. Under certain conditions, there can be leakage through the boreholes and elsewhere between the upper and lower aquifers and provide us not necessarily with the data that we're targeting from that well, you know, meaning if it's a lower aquifer well and we're trying to get information on the lower aquifer, and we're getting upper aquifer influence, then unfortunately we just don't have data on the water quality from the lower aquifer from that well at that time.
Yeah. Okay. And so just to clarify, you did confirm that's not included in the chloride metrics, right? The LA.
Yes.
All right. Yes. I think it's, you know, seeing a downtick during the spring levels is, you know, not surprising. Reduced pumping, some precipitation and things like that might may influence that. So, but I just wanted to make sure it was addressed in our results that is actually creating the chloride metric.
Thank you, Mark and Daniel. Anybody else? Okay, then Laura, can we go to public comment, please?
If you'd like to make a public comment and you're on your phone, please dial *9. And if you're on your computer, please raise your hand. All right, Keith, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Yes, LA-31 is not included in the chloride metric, but it is included in the seawater intrusion front contour line for zone D. So if you leave that the way it is, it's gonna look like seawater intrusion got a lot better when it didn't. So that needs to be changed probably based on earlier data. Also, I think you have it backwards in terms of waiting for a evaluation of the metrics until the model is done. That seems very backwards. Everything should be based on actual evidence that you obtain. I understood that, well, anyway, the chloride metric has significant reliability issues, as Patrick said. I remember Supervisor Gibson in January saying to the effect that the BMC should not be using data from wells with wellbore leakage. And I think he questioned the reason for double weighting data from the Rosina well. The Rosina well, LA-10, not only has wellbore leakage, but is a mixed aquifer well. So you cannot be sure how much the data is influenced by zone D versus zone E. Further, the well has acknowledged variability, as a couple of people have mentioned, in chloride levels, which is stated much like a disclaimer in every annual report. The variability is due to large variations in water levels in response to pumping cycles, a condition that has been well known since before the basin plan was completed, which again raises the question of why Rosina well data is double weighted, and even the question of why the well is used for the metric at all. The chloride metric also has other problems. Two wells, LA-8 and LA-12, are zone D wells. LA-10 is a mixed aquifer zone DE well, and LA-11 is a zone E well. Thus, the metric doesn't give a clear picture of seawater intrusion conditions in zone D or E, and the results, for all the above reasons, can be misleading. For instance, data at one zone E well, LA-11, and the observation well, LA-10, show that seawater intrusion is getting worse in zone E, although the metric indicates seawater intrusion conditions are improving. Clearly, a metric evaluation and more dedicated zone D and E monitoring wells are needed to get a clear picture of seawater intrusion conditions. By the way, several other wells in the lower aquifer monitoring system have these same and other reliability and accuracy issues. There are still 10 lower aquifer water level monitoring wells that have unknown datums and elevation reference points, which can make them 2.8 feet off from what they are supposedly showing. Thank you.
There's no further public comment at this time.
Okay, excuse me, we'll close public comment.
Mr. Chairman, it's Bruce.
Yeah.
Thanks. The imperfections in the metrics that we use have been discussed before, and I think the analysis of them is an important piece of the work effort going forward. So I wouldn't get too obsessed over exactly this particular graph. There's signal and there's noise in there, and it responds to a variety of inputs that is really hard to capture into one number. So I think we get into the second part of this, the next item. We're going to be talking about how we compare calculated information to observed information, and that's a classic scientific deal, a classic scientific challenge. One thing I will say is thank you, Mr. Heimel, for putting the expected curves up, because that's really the crux of our management effort, correct? Is that we have done some calculations as to safe yield. We have, on that basis, taken on a series of infrastructure projects to improve the safe yield and to stabilize the basin. And here we have two of the very important observations that we use in our adaptive management. And so our management management should exactly be tracking. And it's interesting, this one does not appear to have the latest information in the chloride metric, which again bumps down. So what we see there is a certain amount of noise in superimposed on a signal. What's really interesting to me is that a fairly good tracking of the expectation regarding the water level metric. So those are the kinds of things, and extending out into the future, that I think should be the touchstone of our decision-making process. The reality is that we have to make public policy decisions in the face of incomplete data that have certain some levels of uncertainty. And so that's a, you know, that's a challenging thing. And yet at the same time, we have to make those decisions. So again, I think this plotting of the expectations as we accumulate more experience and information will be key to us deciding how we're going to manage the space.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Excuse me. All right, let's
just comment, Marshall. I think there was a comment that Keith made about ALA 31 not included in the seawater intrusion front contouring. Yeah, it's an important comment, and one that we will take into account when we develop the updated contour estimates for the seawater intrusion front that are included in the 2021 annual report. And an acknowledgement that that those data that were collected from that well may not have been representative of actual lower aquifer conditions.
That's Daniel?
All. Yep, thank you.
Okay, so we'll move on to item number 8B, the sustainable yield methodology review and recommendations. BMC staff has been working on this since we put that on their table the last meeting. So we're going to receive information from the staff review of the sustainable yield, the methodology. And this is not an action item. What we're doing on this is providing direction on staff's recommendation regarding, one, the revisions to the methodology, and two, the procedures and timeline by the sustainable yield be calculated each year. So again, this is based on the direction we gave them at our last meeting. Excuse me. So Daniel, I'll turn this over to you. You got X instead of a comma there, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's actually, it's a bit of a terminology that you'll see throughout the presentation. It's kind of how that, so the sustainable yield X kind of represents the sustainable yield for a year X. And so we've utilized this subscript as a way to symbolize that, and a way to differentiate it from a sustainable yield associated with a given year, in which case we'll use the subscript for that given year, which you'll see later in the presentation.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for clarifying that.
Yep. No problem. Thank you for the introduction of this item. As Chair Ohilski described, for this item is to receive information from BMC staff review of the sustainable yield methodology, and to provide direction on staff recommendations, one, regarding potential revisions to the methodology, and two, regarding the procedure and timeline by which the sustainable yield calculations would be made, reviewed by the BMC, approved by the BMC, and then incorporated into the annual monitoring report and other basin monitoring management components. Staff has compiled a couple of recommendations that I'll walk through here with this presentation. But again, this is also an opportunity for the BMC directors to provide additional input to staff as we work through the process of evaluating and updating the sustainable yield estimate to reflect current conditions within the basin. So background, the stipulated judgment and the basin plan have identified a framework for calculating the sustainable yield. And the stipulated judgment outlines that the BMC is required to annually evaluate, confirm, and set a sustainable yield number for the basin that's representative of current infrastructure and conditions. On July 21st, 2021, the BMC gave staff specific direction to review the sustainable yield methodology and assumptions and to bring back recommendations to the BMC for their consideration. And so that's what we're doing here today. Just again, so a little bit more overview of the sustainable yield methodology, as so we all can hopefully have a comprehensive understanding. It's a critical component of the Basin Management Committee's basin monitoring and management. And by definition, as specified in the basin plan, the sustainable yield is defined as the maximum amount of groundwater that can be extracted from the basin with the existing infrastructure in year X. So what infrastructure was placed in year X without, so these are the constraints, without causing seawater to intrusion to advance further inland, or while maintaining a stable seawater intrusion front and with no active well producing water with chloride concentrations above 250 milligrams per liter. So this, again, the sustainable yield is a theoretical production estimate based on current infrastructure and identified constraints or limits primarily associated with the how far seawater could intrude within the basin. The amount of water that can be extracted for calculating the sustainable yield estimate is determined using the existing MOD flow or numeric groundwater model developed for the Los Osos Basin. And that amount of water or the sustainable yield estimate for that year is then used in the basin yield metric, the basin development metric, and then and in the purveyor pool calculations, each of which I will describe on the following slides. I think the place that it's used, and or at least the metric that it's used that I think people are most familiar with is the basin yield metric. The basin yield metric is a comparison of the actual amount of groundwater extracted in a given year with the estimated sustainable yield or theoretical maximum amount of groundwater that could be extracted without violating the constraints described above in that year. And so the equation for the basin yield metric is shown below. Again, actual production divided by sustainable yield estimated production, and then multiply it times 100. The target for the basin yield metric is 80, which basically it, or what it means is the target is 20%. The target is that actual production in the basin is 20% lower than the calculated sustainable yield for the basin for that given year. And this 20% reduction is applied for two reasons primarily. One is to account for uncertainty. There is uncertainty associated with our understanding of the hydrogeology. There's uncertainty associated with, you know, the data that we're able to collect, I think, as we described with some of the individual well measurements. There's some limitations in the tool sets that we have, specifically in that we have a steady state model that we're using to try to predict dynamic conditions. And then there's also uncertainty about future climate, hydrology, and other components. Additionally, as identified in the basin plan, that 20% buffer or safety factor is also applied to target conditions in the basin that would push seawater intrusion back towards the bay, towards the ocean, and away from the inland portions of the basin. And I'll describe that a little bit more on this next slide. What I'm showing here is figure 38 from the basin plan. And this illustrates the sustainable yield calculation as well as the application of the 20% basin yield metric safety factor. So on the graphic on the right, the red line on your right represents where the model anticipates we'll just use the term the seawater intrusion front for now. We can dig into specifically what that means later. Where the model anticipates the seawater intrusion front would be under the sustainable yield pumping estimate, or the equivalent of a basin yield metric of 100, meaning that if pumping was occurring at the level of the sustainable yield, that the model would anticipate seawater would intrude to the extents shown here. However, when you apply the 20% safety factor, or what is roughly the equivalent of a BYM 80, meaning that pumping is occurring at a rate that's 80% less, or 20% less, or 80% of the sustainable yield estimate, the model predicts that that seawater intrusion front would push back towards the bay and away from the developed portions of the community of Los Osos. The other sustainable yield applications I mentioned are the basin development metric. The basin development metric is a comparison of the sustainable yield for year X to the maximum potential sustainable yield that was calculated with the implementation of all of the identified basin plan programs for implementation under the basin plan. So it's really a way to measure the progress that the basin, the BMC parties are able to make towards implementation of the programs identified in the basin plan. And finally, the purveyor pool, or which is a pool or an amount of water that is available to the purveyors for use in a given year. The purveyor pool is calculated or adjusted based on the current estimate of sustainable yield. And shown in the table below is the calculation, an example calculation of the purveyor pool that's included in the stipulated judgment for a sustainable yield estimate of 2,400 acre feet per year. If the sustainable yield estimate changes and the BMC approves that change, then the purveyor pool calculation and amount would change respectively. It should be noted, however, or noted that the non-purveyor pools, the agricultural pool, the community pool, and the private domestic pool, are not adjusted based on changes to the sustainable yield because none of those parties are parties to the stipulated judgment. So now moving into recommendations. The first recommendation, there are two primary recommendations that staff is bringing forth to the BMC today. The first recommendation is with respect to the sustainable yield threshold, or that limiting constraint that's used when calculating how much water can be pumped to determine the sustainable yield amount for that year. And so just a little background here. Previous policy direction that was provided during the development of the stipulated judgment, the basin plan, and previously developed sustainable yield estimates was to allow the calculation of a sustainable yield pumping amount with seawater intrusion further into the basin than has previously occurred to date. In other words, allowing the calculation of a sustainable yield amount based on assumption that seawater could intrude further into the basin than we have seen today, or losing ground to seawater intrusion before that front would stabilize and then meet the definition of for a sustainable yield described previously. BMC staff is proposing to modify this criteria to not allow seawater to intrude further than the observed to date, and it has been observed to date. In other words, holding our ground against seawater intrusion when calculating the sustainable yield estimate for the basin. And I'll explain this a little bit further in the next couple of slides. So here's a slide that looks to illustrate this proposed modification to the seawater intrusion extent. And so if you look at the figure on the right, what you'll see first is two curved lines, and these represent the current estimate of seawater intrusion in zones D and zone E based on the best available information we have for seawater intrusion within the basin. And so what is being proposed, that instead of allowing during the calculation of the sustainable yield estimate this seawater intrusion to intrude further inland before stabilizing. The proposal is to establish these locations as thresholds that cannot be exceeded during the modeling and the calculation of the sustainable yield amount. So there would be a threshold established as shown by this dashed blue line or aquamarine line that would be established for zone D, and then a separate threshold would be established for zone E. And those thresholds would then be utilized as the limiting constraint for calculating the amount of water that could sustainably be pumped from the basin. And to kind of help illustrate that a little bit more, I got a couple additional slides here that show, again, this threshold that is established by the current extents of seawater intrusion in the basin for zone D. And then we're showing contoured TDS concentrations, which can be correlated to chloride concentrations in the basin from the previously calculated sustainable yield estimate of 2,760 acre feet per year. And what you can see here, what is being shown here, is that when calculating the sustainable yield estimate of 2,760 acre feet per year, this seawater intrusion front was allowed to intrude past the current extents of seawater intrusion into the basin before stabilizing at this location and then and meeting the criteria described above of a stable seawater intrusion front and no well producing chloride over 250 milligrams per liter. The proposed methodology or modification to the methodology would change the calculation of sustainable yield such that the model would not be allowed to have seawater intrusion extend any further than this threshold line established for zone D that represents the current extents of seawater intrusion into the basin. And similarly, this would be applied to zone E. So two separate threshold lines developed for the two separate zones of the lower aquifer. Again, this is showing a very similar graph. The dashed orange line represents the current extent of seawater intrusion into zone E. The contoured lines here represent the modeled intrusion past that line included in the sustainable yield calculation associated with 2,760 acre feet per year. And again, the proposed constraint would be to not allow the seawater intrusion in the sustainable yield calculation to go beyond this threshold line and keep it at its current extent within the basin for the purposes of calculating the sustainable yield or the theoretical maximum amount of water that could be extracted from the basin without violating the predetermined criteria. This is an approach that is similar to what is being taken in many Sustainable Groundwater Management Act or SGMA basins, which the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act requires during the development of the groundwater sustainability plans that the agency, the jurisdictional agency, establish what they call sustainable management criteria, which include two primary components. One is the concept of minimum thresholds, and minimum thresholds really represent the last line of defense or the worst possible condition that we don't want to see exceeded. So kind of it is it's kind of an indicator that if that's exceeded, that there's detrimental damage being done to the basin. And then what's also included in the sustainable management criteria is the concepts of measurable objectives. And see, the measurable objective is the goal or the target for groundwater basin conditions that the groundwater sustainability plan would like to achieve. And so applying these concepts to the basin management here in Los Osos, what is being proposed is these seawater intrusion fronts that are represent the current extent of seawater intrusion in the basin could be established as kind of the minimum thresholds. That's the point at which we can't go beyond. And then The measurable objectives could be represented by the anticipated extent of the seawater intrusion front when we apply that 20% reduction or safety factor that we use when calculating the basin yield metric and tracking the health of the basin through that metric. I want one additional slide on this that shows what the model predicts. Again, as I mentioned, that 20% safety factor is designed to account for two things. One, uncertainty within the modeling in the basin, and two, targeting conditions where the seawater intrusion front will be pushed back towards the bay and towards the ocean. And so when you apply the 20% reduction to basin pumping and model that scenario, the model predicts this, as we showed in that earlier graphic from the basin plan, that that seawater intrusion front would move off or, you know, towards the ocean and away from the inland portions of the basin. And so that is staff's recommendation relative to establishing the threshold for calculating the sustainable yield estimate using the model. Again, in summary, the previous threshold allowed for seawater intrusion beyond the current extents of seawater intrusion in the basin when calculating the sustainable yield estimate. The proposed methodology would restrict the extent to which seawater intrusion could move inland in the model to the location of the current extent of seawater intrusion in the basin. In other words, holding ground against seawater intrusion for the purposes of calculating the sustainable yield estimate for the basin. And then when looking at the target for how the agencies would target pumping within the basin yield metric, 20%, a 20% reduction of that sustainable yield amount would be taken. And that would be the target production within the basin that the BMC would use to gauge whether or not it was either above or below that target pumping amount for sustainability within the basin. The other recommendation that staff is bringing forth today is with respect to precipitation. Precipitation is currently modeled at 17.5 inches per year, or the precipitation assumption in the model is 17.5 inches per year. This is based on a correlation that was developed for the Morro Bay Fire Station, which has the longest period of record of rainfall data within our local area, but is then correlated with the South Bay Fire Department to help better represent localized conditions here in the community of Los Osos. BMC staff reviewed this assumption and then evaluated updated estimates utilizing two methodologies to try to incorporate additional hydrologic data in the development of the assumption for rainfall within the model. The first methodology utilized data from the PRISM Climate Group, who develops 30-year isohedral rainfall contours, and there's an image included in the agenda packet showing those rainfall contours. And through an interpolation process, the Los Osos Basin was through a weighted average, a average rainfall for the basin by comparison to those contours was developed. And so the results of those calculations yielded a 17.1 inches per year average rainfall for the Los Osos Basin based on that data set. Just a couple of things to point out, the PRISM Climate Group data set, this is one of the primary data sets that is being utilized by Sigma Basins and their calculation of rainfall for the development of their groundwater sustainability plans. And that, you know, unfortunately, the 1980 to 2010 is the latest available data from the PRISM Climate Group. And so that was what was utilized for this calculation. The second approach included developing an updated correlation between the Morro Bay Fire Station and the Los Osos landfill rainfall gauges. This updated correlation allowed us to incorporate 10 additional years of rainfall data from 2010 to 2020, and then correlate that with recent rainfall data that has been collected from the Los Osos landfill. The results of this correlation yielded an estimated average of 17.5 inches of rainfall for the Los Osos Basin. Based on the results of these two methodologies, the BMC staff recommends reducing the rainfall assumption in the model from 17.5 to 17.3 inches, or the average of the two updated evaluations, for the purposes of calculating the sustainable yield. I wanted to spend a little bit of time examining the rainfall data and some additional justification for those methodologies. It's industry standard practice to obtain the data set with the longest period of record that you can find for rainfall to be able to capture information over changing climatic patterns and wet and dry periods. And so that's why the proposed methodologies include the rainfall data from the Morro Bay Fire Station and the 60 years of data. The other industry standard practice is to, when you're evaluating anticipated rainfall, is to look for a balanced rainfall period. As we all know, living in California, we have periods of increased rainfall and periods of extended drought. And when trying to predict long-term, multi-decade rainfall patterns, it's important to make sure that you're comparing to a data set that both represents wet and dry conditions. And so those are two of the additional reasons why the proposed recommendations for rainfall in the model were made by BMC staff. Just speaking to these figures a little bit, if you look at the cumulative departure from average for rainfall, when the trend line is going down, that represents a time period when rainfall is below average conditions or a drought period. And when the trend is going, when the cumulative departure is going up, those represent periods of time when rainfall is above average conditions. Looking at the recent rainfall patterns that we've seen a declining condition from about 2005 to 2020. Associated with the extended drought periods that we've had over the last decade and a half. But if you go back before that, preceding that, we obviously had some above average hydrologic conditions in the 1990s. And so the objective was to incorporate a balanced rainfall, a balanced period rainfall data set into the model assumptions. Additionally, I guess I would point out, you know, the safety factor, the 20% safety factor, is added to the sustainable yield estimate to account for any potential future changes in climatic conditions. There are a number of other assumptions that go into the sustainable yield calculation. These include the amount of water that infiltrates through Los Osos Creek through stream bed seepage, the amount of recycled water that's delivered to Rodderson and Bay Ridge Estates, the sea level, the elevation of the ocean included in the model, and then the non-purveyor pumping assumptions. When calculating the sustainable yield, the non-purveyor pumping is a fixed amount, and it's the purveyor pumping that is adjusted for the purposes of calculating the sustainable yield. And so the assumptions regarding non-purveyor pumping are shown in this table here. Based on BMC staff's review of these parameters, we're not recommending a significant modification to the approach or assumptions with respect to these parameters at this time, but are recommending a modification to the threshold for determining sustainability, the rainfall, and open to input from the BMC into any other parameters that they may want to see evaluated in calculating the updated sustainable yield estimate. So that's an overview of the methodology and the assumptions and the recommended modifications. The next part of the presentation covers some more of the procedural components. So the sustainable yield update requirements. Here's some language from the stipulated judgment, you know, that requires, so prior to the start of year X, following the commencement of the stipulated judgment, the BMC shall establish a sustainable yield for that year based on conservation implemented and infrastructure then developed in the basin and the model. And with unanimous consent, the BMC shall annually evaluate, confirm, and set the sustainable yield estimate. Any change to the sustainable yield shall be based upon the best available and then existing data and evidence. And so to provide a little bit more specificity to exactly how this process could play out in the Basin Management Committee's annual review and report development cycle, we developed these proposed more detailed procedures. So starting in July, it's proposed BMC staff would evaluate the sustainable yield and make modification recommendations to the Basin Management Committee if determined appropriate. If the Basin Management Committee approves the recommended modifications, staff would then prepare the updated sustainable yield calculations. These updated calculations would then be presented to the BMC for approval. And if unanimously approved, then documented the annual report for that year and then used in the calculation of the basin yield metric, the basin development metric, and the purveyor pool for the upcoming year. If the updated sustainable yield calculations were not unanimously approved by the BMC, then the sustainable yield would remain the same as previously approved, and the BMC would provide directions to staff for how to proceed. It gets a little confusing there when you're talking about calculating a sustainable yield estimate for an upcoming year, but then you're preparing an annual report for this year. And so we put together an example timeline to help kind of illustrate, you know, how this proposed process could play out on an annual basis. So taking this year, for example, in July, BMC staff began an evaluation of a sustainable yield estimate for the year 2022. And the BMC would then present recommendations for the sustainable yield calculation for year 2022. And so we're in the process of doing that now. Before January 2022, if the BMC approves the sustainable yield estimate for 2022, then that estimate, the sustainable yield estimate approved by the BMC, would be used to establish the purveyor pool for the year 2022. It would also be incorporated into the basin yield and basin development metrics for the 2022 annual report. And then because the 2022 annual report isn't going to be generated for a year approximately, we would propose to describe the sustainable yield calculation for year 2022 in the 2021 annual report as a way of documenting that decision for future reference. And then finally, some financial considerations. Through the evaluation and development of these recommendations, Cleve Harris Geologist has been stacked with providing additional analysis and attending numerous additional meetings to support the development of these updated calculations. And so the BMC Executive Director is requesting authorization to utilize $12,000 of the contingency/technical assistance funds included in the approved calendar year 2021 budget, of which there are currently $40,000 available, to compensate Cleve Harris Geologist for their additional effort on this critical initiative for the monitoring and management of the Los Osos Basin. And that concludes my presentation for item 8B.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. I'd like to express my appreciation to BMC staff and the executive director and the hard work that they put into this. So do we have any questions or comments before we go to public comments?
I have a couple comments, but I'm willing to go later if others want to speak first, but I can certainly jump in now. So I agree. Thanks, Dan, for putting this effort together. Presentation has a lot of information in it. There's many moving parts to this equation here. One of the things, I generally agree with the methodology of using the line to not allow the basin to fluctuate or the seawater intrusion to fluctuate. And so one of the things that caught my attention is the existing infrastructure. So during your definition of sustainable yield, you talked about the existing infrastructure in place, but I think some of the variable is that we were preloading that infrastructure and the impact of that infrastructure, maybe because it wasn't completed yet or because of some operational constraints. And so, I mean, could that first step be that we simply back out those assumptions? Because I believe that that's where the sustainable yield increased was project based, and each project had a contribution based on its pumping and hydraulic pumping in the basin. And so that's just one of my comments that I'd like to see us do, is to look at that aspect of it when we come back. I'm anticipating we're going to come back with some of these runs and actually look at figures and how this impacts, but generally in agreement with the methodology to not allow that seawater intrusion to move. But once again, there's a lot of moving parts there, and not sure I fully understand what those impacts are going to be and how we're going to get there, but interested to learn more about it. Then as far as the procedure, generally okay with that. As I look at the complexity of this and the timeline and trying to come up with this by the end of the year, that is a little bit concerning to me, because I don't want to rush through this. One of the things that we talked about in our July 21st was the actual metrics and the sustainable yield number. Is that an accurate number to use today or not? And we were going to look at that. Some of those variables I just mentioned may play into that. Didn't see a lot of that analysis, but I'm hoping that we're going to see that coming back in our next meeting. We're faced with, do we keep the sustainable yield number as it is today, make some changes, take a step back and actually look at these assumptions and the numbers that we created over time, and maybe take a step back and go back to our original 2400, because when we talk about this timeline, it took us about 10 years to get to the basin plan. And this had a long time to vet and be created. And now we're trying to do it in a matter of months and make some changes. And so a little leery about making quick changes like that and what those impacts are. But generally in agreement. I'll just stop there and let the other comment.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Does anybody else have a comment or question before we go to public comment?
Yeah, Marshall, this is Bruce. I just want to confirm with Daniel, when we talk about the assumptions of extractions from the basin, those extractions are modeled as to where they are laterally and vertically in the basin. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah. That's
really the whole point of the infrastructure program is to do the extractions at the right places, vertically and horizontally, which can maximize the sustainable yield of the basin. So, you know, I agree with Mark to the extent when we calculate sustainable yield, we should put the assumptions in with the infrastructure that is in place. And that's a given. But that's easy to know, right? We know what wells are working, where they are, and so forth. I think the other two things that I want to come back to when we have deliberation after public comment is the need to have a transient model to make this work, and the need to have some policy language in our guidelines for doing this calculation that points us to doing updates of the sustainable yield number on an appropriate time scale. By that, I mean, I don't think it's in the interest of good management in this basin to be updating the sustainable yield number every year. I think that could, and I'll talk a little bit more about that after public comment, that could end up with some, how shall I say, less than ideal management decisions being made. We have to take the appropriate time scale into account as we calculate a sustainable yield and as we interpret observations that are made to see how we're doing on it. But those are the two things I think are important, along with having an appropriate set of observations to confirm our calculations sustainable yield. So we'll get back to that after comment.
Okay. Charlie, you're the last one. I'm going to hold my stuff until after public comments. So.
Right. I think I will too. I have a lot of comments and I'll wait.
Okay. All right. Let's go to public comment, Laura.
If you'd like to make a public comment and you're on your phone, please dial *9. And if you're on your computer, please raise your hand. All right, Keith, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. And I too want to thank staff for all the work on this. I also want to say at last, because the LOSG has been saying since 2013 that the basin plan definition of sustainable yield should be changed because it allows seawater intrusion to advance, causing an undesirable effect. So really, I thank you finally, I won't even say finally, just thank you for digging into it. And I really appreciate that you've come up with this information at this point. However, I do want to point out some problems with the proposal, and it relates a lot to just the fact that things need to be based on measurable evidence. First, it is not possible to set the minimum threshold at the location of current seawater intrusion fronts because you don't know exactly where the fronts are. In the most recent annual report, Cleve Harris agrees with the LOSG that more wells are needed to delineate the positions of the fronts. And I want to remind you that the Zone E front location is now an estimate. Also, setting the minimum threshold for seawater intrusion at current locations assumes the current locations are desirable. The estimated extent of Zone E intrusion is not desirable, nor is the extent of Zone D intrusion at a point inland of the Rosina well. On the other hand, moving the fronts to under the estuary, which is the goal of the basin yield metric of 80, is a desirable condition. So the LOSG continues to support a sustainable yield definition and value that maintains fronts under the estuary. This may be the same thing that you're talking about, but I believe that when you set a minimum threshold, it should be probably one line. My understanding of sigma minimum thresholds is different, I think, from what is being proposed. Minimum thresholds for seawater intrusion, as I understand them, are minimum chloride levels at individual wells used to delineate a front. This eliminates the potential for a goal or objective to be reached on paper, with seawater intrusion still advancing at one or more locations, as happens now with the chloride metric. Regarding the proposed methodology, the proposal for setting the sustainable yield does not use the best available data and evidence as required. It still relies primarily on modeling and also water use estimates, by the way, that are not verified by measurable data. For instance, there are no data to show that the yield will increase with seawater and seawater intrusion will reverse as a result of installing expansion well number one, current conservation measures, or discharging recycled water at the Bergson leach fields.
Please, you've reached your 3 minutes.
I have one more point if I can make it.
Mr. O'Hilsky?
Can I make that, Marshall?
How long?
Probably about 20 seconds.
Okay, go ahead.
The proposal doesn't recommend enough parameter changes. You should have Cleith Harris run scenarios without Burson leach fields operational, which is the current condition, at least 10% less rainfall. Just use the Los Osos landfill data. There's also a change in basin structure based on the expansion well number two test hole. And you should have scenarios run with infrastructure programs not increasing the yield, even reducing the yield. The model and BMC now assume moving wells inland into the upper aquifer will only increase yields. However, moving wells can have beneficial effects, no effects, or negative effects. Assuming they provide only beneficial effects, when water levels appear to be getting lower in a large pumping depression, is wishful thinking and can result in harm to the basin. Thanks a lot for letting me go further.
All right, Jeff, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Edwards, and I'm speaking to item 8B. Is this really the analysis directed at your July 21st meeting? I'm not clear at all that this was the direction. Moreover, it would appear premature to do this work and have this discussion using the steady state model. Aren't we getting the transient model funded by the county? This would be the time to have this kind of discussion and do this kind of analysis. I would agree with the premise of maintaining a stable seawater intrusion front with no active well producing water with chloride concentrations above 250 mg/L. However, I disagree as unrealistic the notion that we target basin conditions that would push the freshwater seawater interface or seawater intrusion front seaward to protect against uncertainty. Again, unrealistic. We need to focus. This is not rocket science. We have program C wells number 2 and 3 to install, neither of which are complete. Let's get that accomplished. Let's get off the Palisades well, and those would be meaningful contributions. And again, with the transient model, well, then we can do some calculations. Also, I object to the proposed alternative approach to calculating the sustainable yield. Perhaps you're familiar with the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid. That's what we need to focus on. This whole effort is a make work endeavor for WSC and CHG. Don't do it. Don't do any more work on this. Spend any more money without the transient model, again, that the county is going to fund. Establishing a new threshold is inconsistent with how basins with similar seawater intrusion threats. This is a quote from the staff report. Well, what other basins did WSG rely on that have similar threats? I'm unclear on that, of course. Then as to other basin management committee efforts, the stream inflow at 800 acre feet per year, which is 20% of the estimated runoff. What about an inflatable dam at the bridge at Los Osos Valley Road in the creek? That would bump the 800 acre feet up. Also, we're putting water at Bay Ridge Estates and killing the oak trees. We need to rethink that. Then lastly, this idea of 500 wells out there, private wells, is ridiculous. The health department generated stats. There's 330 wells approximately, of which 60% or 200 are not active. So really we have about 130 active wells that consume about 100 acre feet per year from private domestic use. Let's set up a program, and I'll close with this, Mr. Chairman. Let's set up a program that we can abandon the roughly 200 inactive wells in this community. That's a real strategy. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Lindy, you just have to unmute yourself.
Okay, thank you, Laura. I guess I had a variety of things that came up. Again, we don't know how well Brodersen's doing. We don't know if it will ever perform as expected. It could be another 10 years. So I find that difficult to still be including in calculations. I also have to agree with Jeff Edwards that pushing back the seawater intrusion fronts is unrealistic. I don't see how we can put water into existing areas and get rid of the salt water and push it back. The ocean's mighty powerful. I just really urge caution. Everything that we do is our future. And if we blow it now, that's just, it means that we did studies that we relied on without using a lot of common sense. And I appreciate Keith's input on a lot of that. I didn't like the assuming a 0.2 decrease for rain amounts because we're going into new areas. One issue that I've noticed is that the rain is not even anymore. It drops in loads in one place and barely drops in another place. So we may need to factor in the fact that if a rain gauge shows something, it doesn't mean that it's overall. So we need more variety of collection data to not get into trouble with our rainfall. And then I wanted to question, is the Memorial Park really receiving 50 acre feet? I have not heard that they ever got hooked in. Then I looked at the table 3 pool allocation based on sustainable yield. It says there that the private domestic pool is estimated at 150 acre feet. Yet further down, you go to another, I'm trying to find it here, where you actually say that it is 220 for private domestic. You can't have I don't understand, that's the assumed pumping rate. So I wonder if there's an error there. And that's my comments. I just want us to have lots more caution than I can't depend on modeling. Thank you.
Thank you, Lindy.
All right, Patrick, you just have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. And I too would like to thank Dan and staff and the rest of the purveyors for working on all of this. I do have a question though, and it's not rhetorical. You speak of revising the methodology for recalculating the sustainable yield. And the methodology is clearly outlined in the stipulated judgment, as you pointed out. You just haven't used it yet. So what methodology have you been using? In the agenda packet, it mentions a previously developed sustainable yield estimate and a current sustainable yield estimate. Though in the July BMC meeting, it was established and agreed upon that no safe yield had ever been approved and that the 2760 acre feet yearly being used was based on assumptions in uncompleted projects and would and has caused seawater intrusion to advance even further into our aquifer. So I am confused as to what methodology is being revised. And as far as procedure goes, to establish the safe yield, you are at the start of each year following the comment and the stipulated judgment, the Basin Management Committee shall establish the safe yield for that year based on conservation implemented and basin plan infrastructure, then developed in the basin and the model using best available existing data and evidence. The problem I see is we don't have any conservation measures implemented and we don't have any real conclusive evidence or data to go by, but that is the procedure you must follow. No hypotheticals, no assumptions. Regarding water level, Where is the data that supports an increase in water level? And in ending, I have a question for either Dan or Marshall. And again, it's not rhetorical, but and deserves a response. Who are these staff members that keep coming up? And with their assumptions and recommendations, what are their qualifications? Are they hydrologists? Are they meteorologists? Who are they? I hope the purveyors have enough sense to refute some of these recommendations. But again, I'd like to know who these people are that the BMC depends on. Thank you.
Thank you,
Pat. There's no further public comment at this time.
Okay. We'll close public comment. Excuse me. But before we go to discussion, Daniel, do you want to answer a few of those questions or should we just throw that into the discussion?
Yeah, Marshall, I can address some of those. There was a comment from Keith about can't set the front because we don't know where the front is located. We're using the best available data that we have to characterize the seawater intrusion front. And, you know, I think, and we're establishing a generalized location for that. And then we'll continue to monitor actual conditions relative to that and use that information to inform our understanding of the movement of that front. But I mean, we need to be able to set parameters to plan around and to measure against. And so the data is never going to be perfect. We're never going to have enough data. I agree that we need more dedicated monitoring wells. We'd be very supportive of that. But in the meantime, we need to be able to make management decisions for the basin and then monitor them against actual conditions. And so that's where the model is the best available tool set that we have, and we need to use it so that we can at least try to predict future conditions, make informed decisions around new basin infrastructure, and manage the basin to the best that we can with the tools that we have. Current locations are not desirable. There were questions about sustainable management criteria from other basins. We may not have followed their approach exactly with target chloride conservation, chloride concentrations within specific wells, but following the general concepts, at least from what I'm familiar from the 180, 400 foot Salinas Basin, the Mid-County Basin up in Santa Cruz, both of those GSPs, to my understanding, targeted their minimum thresholds around no more seawater intrusion, stopping it where it is today, and then ideally implementing projects or management actions to achieve some sort of measurable objective or improved condition relative to seawater intrusion in those basins. Sensitivity analysis. There has been sensitivity analysis done with respect to rainfall, and that's available in a previous adaptive management technical memorandum, I believe the 2017 Cleith Harris TM. You know, maybe that's worth revisiting with the BMC so everybody can have a kind of an understanding, at least of a sensitivity of the sustainable yield estimates to assumptions with respect to rainfall. Additional comments. The transient model agreed would be a much better tool for making these decisions, but a transient model is, you know, unfortunately, much appreciated the county has contributed funding for the BMC to move forward on the transient model, but transient models aren't built overnight. The transition and the development of the transient model will take a number of years. And so we need to be able to make management decisions in the meantime, and utilizing the steady state model that we have now is appropriate and what we should move forward with. Other questions? Pushing back seawater intrusion, comment about being that unrealistic. I guess I disagree with that assessment. Seawater intrusion is completely, not completely, but primarily tied to the hydraulics within the groundwater basin. If we can increase groundwater levels in the upper and lower aquifers and pressures within those aquifers, we can see progress made towards pushing seawater intrusion back. I've observed that in other basins, and the physics and the science support that. And so I think that is a worthy goal of targeting basin conditions that do allow us to gain ground on seawater intrusion. There was a question about the private pumping estimates in table three, one of the earlier slides, not matching the private pumping estimates in the latter slides. And I'd like to clarify that. That table three in the earlier slide is the copy of the pool allocation calculations included in the stipulated judgment, not intended to be representative of the current purveyor pool calculations. And so the estimates of private domestic and community and to a lesser extent, well, agriculture have also changed since the development of the stipulated judgment. And so that's why we're seeing a 220 acre feet per year figure in the assumptions built into the sustainable yield model calculations compared to 150 back when the stipulated judgment was developed. I guess, and just one comment from my perspective, we can spend a lot of time arguing about whether or not the previous estimates of sustainable yield followed the exact procedures of the stipulated judgment and spend, probably quite a bit of money on legal fees. Or I think we have an opportunity here to really work together and evaluate, take an objective evaluation of this methodology and come up with a sustainable yield figure that we can all to agree to and use for basin monitoring and management moving forward. And then finally, the question about BMC staff. I mean, the BMC has a very limited staff. I would define BMC staff as myself and to a lesser extent, a Cleve Harris geologist. So we're the staff. I'm a registered civil engineer with a background in water resource planning. Spencer Harris is a certified hydrogeologist and probably one of the most knowledgeable individual of Los Osos groundwater conditions that we have. And that are the comments I'm ready to address at this point.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. All right, let's open up the discussion. Who would like to go first?
This is Charlie from S&T, and if you don't mind, I'd like
to go ahead.
I have six points I'd like to make, and I'm going to do them two at a time in order to get other people some time to talk and also so you don't have to listen to my silly voice for such a long period of time. Thanks to staff for this. This is one of the most important agenda items we've had at the Basin Management Committee since 2015 when I began coming to these meetings. And especially thanks to Dan Heimel. We're very fortunate to have somebody of Dan Heimel's caliber working with us. So my first comment is about slide 17, Dan, of your presentation about the basin yield metric. Really complete that, I want to think of that basin yield figure, you had that equation up there, as actually being associated with a year X, the same year X as the sustainable yield figure in that equation on your slide 17. You didn't write it like that, but I think it's important. We had a situation in this last annual report, which I voted against. So you can see that in that equation, you left out the subscript X for basin yield metric. It was just an accident. But we had a situation in this last annual report in which we had a basin yield metric less than 80% during a year when the sustainable yield was obviously violated, was wrong, because we had advancing seawater intrusion. I don't know, I'd like somebody to help me reconcile how that could ever happen, that the basin yield metric could be less than 100% while still having seawater, rampant seawater intrusion during that same year. But let's just move on here. And now I want to talk a little bit about this factor of safety that we keep talking about, that this basin yield metric of 80 allows for uncertainty. That 20% represents a factor of safety of 1.2 to 1. And those of you who are familiar with engineering practices, something like a class 8 bolt, the yield strength of that class 8 bolt is reported with a factor of safety of 2. And when I build a bolted joint, I have many of these factors of safety. When I put together the entire arithmetic for a bolted joint, I apply another factor of safety of 2. The resulting factor of safety for that bolted joint becomes something like a factor of safety of 600%. So I just want to dispel any kind of false ideas that this 20% or a factor of safety of 1.2 to 1 is conservative. It is not. Okay. Sorry about my tone of voice. I'll try to keep that from happening. That's my first point. So I don't want, S&T is going to be watching this, and we don't want to have that happen again, where we have a basin yield metric reported of under 100%. At the same year, we're having seawater intrusion increasing. Don't believe that should ever happen. My next comment is about the sustainable yield associated with slide 20, and associated with the idea that staff is proposing to hold the seawater front at its present location. This is an untenable situation or an untenable suggestion for S&T Mutual Water Company, who our service area is west of the seawater front that we're talking about holding the line on. S&T Mutual Water Company currently does not have a sustainable water source in the western part of the basin. The last remaining water source that we have is our LA-8 well, which is in a declining state because of permitted sewage pollution. And the time is ticking on that. We are likely to have to replace that well. That well will no longer be of use to us in 10 more years. All of our wells at that point will be either polluted with sewage or saltwater intrusion. If holding the line at the present location for seawater intrusion is a discriminatory idea, discriminating against S&T Mutual Water Company, the other two water purveyors have holdings in their service areas, which extend eastward beyond the present seawater intrusion line. And that's much different than S&T Mutual Water Company's holdings. S&T, within the next 10 years, is likely to have to, well, we're going to create an intertie. That's a great thing, and interties are good for resiliency to do at any rate, for any reason. But to create an intertie for our sole source of water means purchasing water from another purveyor at prices beyond, which I mean greater than retail. That's sort of a very distasteful idea for S&T. So the long-term prospects of holding the seawater front where it currently is a non-starter for S&T, and we will vote against any policy like that. Those are my first two comments, and I'm going to stop now. I have four more, and I'll let somebody else talk for a little while.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. Bruce or Mark?
Well, I don't have any particular comments other than the ones that I laid out. I think the explanation, I don't believe the sustainable yield was violated. That goes to my point of the need for a transient model. You know, the calculation of sustainable yield is a calculation. Some people get hung up on modeling, you know, versus observation. We have a resource here. We need to calculate as best we can how much of that resource we think we can extract without causing undesirable effects. That's the sort of the sigma approach to it. The reality is that the things we measure are going to fluctuate on a year by year basis. I don't necessarily agree there was rampant seawater intrusion, as you can see from the slides there that we saw on the previous item. The chloride metric, imperfect as it is, or the chloride amount in any given well, is going to vary from year to year because of a lot of things, including the amount of rainfall. So that's really what I was getting at, is that we need to calculate a sustainable yield that makes sense, and then make observations to see if in fact our calculation was right. The transient model will allow us to more on a shorter time scale calculate how we think our observations might change, and you know, the dynamic nature of the response of the basin was shown in that chloride and water metric slide that we saw, where you saw that certain changes in inputs were going to occur in the basin. You know, up one more forward. There you go. So you see, we made certain amount of changes, and chloride continues to increase before it decreases. That's the dynamic nature of the basin. It's not simply a bathtub. There are other things going on. The water level metric on the whole is going to increase. So, you know, I think that setting the sea level intrusion front at its current location and calculating sustainable yield such that it doesn't move further east is actually a pretty conservative assumption. I get Charlie's observations about the challenges that S&T faces, and they absolutely need to be addressed. But by the dynamic nature of the basin, you know, holding the line on seawater intrusion rather than letting it go forward is actually a step in the conservative direction. You know, as to the factor of safety by the basin yield metric, I mean, that's baked into the basin management plan through the stipulated judgment. And I would submit that if you look at any groundwater basin, which does an accurate, you know, the best job of calculating its sustainable yield, and then only extracts 80% of that, that basin is doing extraordinarily well. There would be no basin that I can think of that's doing that well, doing as well as that, that has any significant amount of actual draw. So that goes back to my idea that in calculating the sustainable yield, let's do the best we can. Let's continue forward with the transient model, predicting our observations. Let's compare our actual observations to the projections and make adjustments to our management on a timescale that makes sense, which I don't think we should be doing every year, because I think we will end up overcorrecting in a variety of ways, good and bad, if we take that approach. That's all I got at this point.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. All right, Charlie, we're back to you.
Okay, yeah, I can agree with Director Gibson on his point about not attempting to change a sustainable yield figure every year. And that brings me to one of my, this actually point five, I'm gonna skip one, that in the proposed process here in this agenda item, there is a proposal that for a policy in which if the board, the Basin Management Committee board, can't agree on a sustainable yield figure for 2022, for instance, which is our next task to do before 31st of December this year, the proposal is to allow the sustainable yield figure to remain where it was as presented in the disputed annual report of 2020. And I strongly disagree with that. I don't like that figure. That figure for sustainable yield occurred and produced a basin yield metric for that same year that looked like a very nice bumper sticker to put on some property development's rear bumper. My proposal is for this policy, which would require unanimous vote, would be that if we can't agree on the default sustainable yield figure for the 2022 annual report, that we should default back to the 2,400 acre feet per year figure as directed by the stipulated judgment. Because I believe we did all agree that no sustainable yield figure had ever been properly adopted by the BMC board since the stipulated judgment indicated that our sustainable yield figure should be 2,400 acre feet per year and remain that way for 5 years unless changed by a unanimous vote of the BMC board. And since that never happened, I believe that we should default back to that 2,400 acre feet per year as dictated by the stipulated judgment. One more point, and then I'll let somebody else talk, and I still have one more after that. On the precipitation estimates, the proposal for changing the precipitation estimate for modeling. I object to the 17 feet or 17 inches per year of rainfall for modeling purposes. I find that is very optimistic, and I question the choices of the data sets. I think that I would like, I've sent a data set from the county Los Osos landfill site to BMC staff to have them review that. The basin, the Los Osos landfill site, which goes back to 2005, the 2005 water year, has a median rainfall from 2005 to 2020 of 13.9 inches per year. And that median, by the way, the median is different from average, right? We agree. The average is a little bit higher. In fact, let me get that up. I'll see what the average at that site is. The average at that site for that entire data set is 15.9 inches per year. That includes the jackpot rainfall years of the early 2000s that were on Dan's plot of rainfall from the Morro Bay sites. To choose the Morro Bay data is to choose data that presents a very optimistic view of rainfall in the future. The landfill site, which is closer to our water basin, it's right at the edge of our water basin, it probably is a little bit more realistic. Yeah, you can see here on Dan's plot that he has up now, his slide 26, what I'm calling the jackpot rainfall years of the early 2000s. I don't know why we would expect that to reoccur. And if we bet on that, we're betting the basin on that. I don't think it's a good idea to go into a modeling program with very optimistic data. I would prefer to go in to a modeling program with inputs that are conservative. I don't know that you could even call the Los Osos landfall data conservative. It is what it is. So I propose that we use the median rainfall from the Los Osos landfall fill site from 2005 to 2020, which is 13.9 inches per year. And so those are the next two of my comments, and I'll stop again and let anybody comment, and I have two more comments.
Okay. I'll make a comment regarding Charlie's comment on the defaulting back to the 2400. I don't know if that's the right approach, but just going back to my original comment kind of tied into that from that original 2400 and development of the basin plan over 10 years, lots of input and time to develop the plan. We made some changes along the way based on projects that were included in the plan. And those projects had a contribution to increasing the sustainable yield. And so what I think would be a better approach, we start at the 2400, direct staff to go back and look at those projects. I don't think that's to go back and look at those projects and confirm the amount of contribution that those projects added. And I think it ties into what I was saying about the variability and the movement of the seawater front. That's what accounted for that, because we knew that some of these projects were going to take time to develop, like the Broderson Mound. And so during that time, there was going to be some movement of seawater intrusion. Today, that mound still isn't developed. There was also a few of the wells and how these wells operate in the constraints of operation. You know, there's compliance. We have to run certain wells to keep them operating according to our permit. There's mechanical, maintenance and failures that have to come into play that rely on other operation configurations. So looking back at these contribution of projects and ultimately what contributed to increasing the sustainable yield from the 2400, that seems like something we should consider and direct staff to do. So I would support something of that nature and come back next time, looking at a completely new approach and threshold and numbers. At this time, I think that's something we should do down the road, but right now that's going to just create more complexity and confusion. I think we should stick with our approach now, confirm what that number is, and if there is nothing that comes in place that warrants changing that, we leave the number the way it is today, but I think looking at the facts and information we have at hand was really what we tasked staff to do. Let's take that approach is something I would support.
Okay, I guess I'd like to, and Mark, Director Zimmer, if I could, I just to kind of help clarify the understanding. So my understanding of, the reasons for the increase of from the 2,400 acre feet per year to 2,760 acre feet per year sustainable yield increase that was calculated and incorporated in the 2017 annual report was to account for the construction and completion of the first program seawell completed by Golden State, and then the anticipated completion of the upper aquifer LSO CSD well at 8th Street. And so, you know, we can revisit that, but I think that my understanding is relatively clear that that increase was made because of those two projects. And so the first program seawell is up and running and operational. Now, granted, the upper aquifer H Street well has not been fully completed, primarily due to delays associated in pursuing and obtaining grant funding, but will be completed very soon. And so I guess if we can revisit those calculations, but I would think, I don't know that, I think the assumptions and the sustainable yield numbers associated, unless we change the methodology and the definition of sustainability as proposed here, isn't going to change, and we will end up, will stay at the 2,760 acre feet per year sustainable yield number.
Yeah, I think there's a few more that contributed to that. You know, the Urban Water Reinvestment Program, it was A and U, A and C projects, and the skyline nitrate removal and upper aquifer utilization. So there was these steps along the way that we, you know, one of the most significant ones was the Urban Water Reinvestment Program, and so I'm not that well versed on the county or the district's actions. I just know a couple in Golden State. It would warrant looking at those numbers. Could we reach that maximum potential that is defined in that assumption of that project? Just maybe something, you know, that we can move forward with right here. Trying to look for something that, you know, how do we move forward? And like I say, if that effort comes out and that number is 2760, then that is the number, and let's move forward. For now, you know, we can definitely go back in subsequent years, but I, you know, any changes we make, I just want to make sure we make those changes and they're helpful and accurate. I don't want to make changes that we're doing quickly and may cause additional confusion down the road. So Dan, one of your recommendations is to go back and have Spencer perform some additional analysis.
Could I jump in on that, Mark?
Sure, please help.
I'm thinking, you know, so we're gonna approve a methodology today. Presumably, we're gonna send Spencer off to calculate the sustainable yield. One of the things he would do, I would assume, is confirm the accuracy of the assumptions regarding the effect of infrastructure, right? So I think that's naturally part of this process.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, Dan, can you confirm that? And really, so jumping back to that July 21st meeting, confirming those assumptions was really the direction. Now we have a change in methodology. And to me, if I don't know if I would support using it this year. I think it sounds good. It warrants some consideration and generally agree with it, but the timing of it, I don't want to rush through it, would be my caution.
Okay, thank you, Mark. All right, Charlie.
Okay, thank you. Mark Zimmer's, Director Zimmer's comments are well thought out, and I appreciate those thoughts. I'd like to talk about the pumping of non-metered production estimates. When we come back to a new meeting, and I hope we're not going to cancel any more meetings. I hope, if anything, we're going to require additional meetings this year toward the end of the year to get this done. And I hope we're not going to cancel any more meetings from here to the end of the year. And I hope, well, I'm not going to make the next comment, but so the pumping of non-metered production estimates. I think in a presentation of a proposal for a new sustainable yield figure, I think that the Basin Management Committee members deserve to see a detailed detailed evidence or detailed reasoning behind how those estimates are made. I think it's very important for the sustainable yield method. I know that we have to make these estimates, and I know that the process for making these estimates is laid out in detail in our basin management plan document. But I'd like to have a more detailed discussion about that during presentation of a sustainable yield figure proposal. The next comment I have is a happy one. And it is that yes, S&T agrees wholeheartedly to increasing the budget to cover the cost of the proper management of determining these sustainable yield figures and a larger investment in an open public discussion of sustainable, not just the sustainable yield figure, but these bumper sticker metrics that we produce in our annual reports. That's worth the money, and S&T wholeheartedly approves the increasing the budget as proposed in this agenda item.
Is that it, Charlie?
That's it. And I'm sure that there's a lot of things that I've said right now are fairly condensed that people have missed. But remember that S&T does not have a sustainable water source.
Right.
We're admitting it right out loud. The other two water purveyors may have different opinions about their own water sources. And I hope you understand what it means to the shareholders of S&T, our 591 water customers, when there's a proposal that we should try to hold the water, the seawater intrusion front at a place east, well east of our geographical service area. That I hope that you can understand how that would make our water customers feel.
Yep. Okay, thank you. All right, Daniel, would you like to respond to these comments so we can move forward here?
Yeah, let me do that. So, and Director Cody did a nice job of numbering for me, so that I think is helpful. The first one was from Director Cody, is a basin yield metric of less than 80, but still seeing seawater intrusion. I guess my response to that comment is that, you know, based on the current methodology that in the previous policy direction was provided, seawater intrusion is allowed to further intrude in the calculation of the sustainable yield estimate. And so that's inherently kind of baked into the methodology that has been previously utilized for calculating the sustainable yield estimate. And, you know, something I think that we should address, that I don't think allowing seawater to intrude further into the basin meets my definition of sustainability. And so just a thought there. Basin yield factor of safety. Director Cody's a much more of an expert on factors and safety, but I thought Director Gibson's comments about comparing this basin relative to other basins with seawater intrusion issues, it was a good one. I mean, I think there are many coastal basins with seawater intrusion and intruding at a much more rapid rate. I think we've got an opportunity here in Los Osos through proper management to stop seawater intrusion where it is. And I think we should take every effort to do that. The third comment from Director Cody about holding seawater intrusion where it is not tenable. I understand the position that S&T Mutual is in, and I think I would like to work closely with the S&T representatives and the other purveyors to find a solution that is tenable, that ensures that everybody in Los Osos has a sustainable water supply and that is not threatened by seawater and or nitrate or other contamination. Bruce's comments about needing a transient model, or Director Gibson's comments about needing a transient model, I think we're well spoken. I think there's lots of agreement around that. And we're gonna be working towards that. And that'll be one of the things we bring forth in the budget proposals for calendar year 2022. With respect to the questions or comment about recalculating the sustainable yield or not recalculating the sustainable yield every year, I agree. I think, you know, we had a discussion around that at the last meeting, briefly at the end, but, you know, as outlined in the stipulated judgment of the basin plan, you know, the recalculation, you know, once there's an agreed upon methodology is only warranted when there's a significant change in the basin infrastructure or a significant change in kind of our understanding of conditions within the basin. And that year over to year variations in pumping or water levels or chlorides don't warrant a recalculation of the sustainable yield. It's a number and a methodology established to help predict a long-term value for how much water can be pumped from the basin and not a year over year value. The comment from Director Cody about the previous sustainable yield not properly approved and defaulting to the 2,400 acre feet per year number, if we can't agree on a new sustainable yield, I guess I would respond to that saying that the intention, at least the language in the staff report and the presentation, was not trying to posture one way or another of what sustainable yield we would default to. It's just that we would default to the previously approved sustainable yield by the Basin Management Committee. And again, I think we can spend a lot of time arguing about whether or not that was properly done the last time, or we can try to work together to move forward and agree on a sustainable yield number that we can move forward with. The comments from Director Cody about precipitation, I think, are good. I'd like to explore more with Director Cody about, you know, any discrepancies. I think we have a slight difference in the calculations from BMC staff of 16.1 inches per year versus 15.9. I think we can look at that. You know, I'm sure we can address that. That's just a data issue. With regard to precipitation, I understand the comments of, you know, wanting to look at more recent trends. I made some statements about balanced hydrologic periods and period of record. I mean, I think all of that is important and needs to be accounted for. I mean, the other thing we need to account for is climate change. And, you know, we haven't jumped in detail, at least since in my tenure here at the BMC, with discussions around climate change and potential impacts on the basin. And maybe we need to do that. I just anecdotally, or more than anecdotally, I mean, I've been involved in climate change studies for other local water resources in San Luis Obispo County. And many of the models and the predictions for climate change in our region are for warmer and wetter conditions moving forward. And how do we account for that in our modeling and our estimate of sustainable yield? I mean, there is guidance out there from the state and other agencies that we can use for that. And, you know, at some point, I think we need to potentially incorporate some of that guidance into the calculations of rainfall that we may or may not anticipate moving forward. Director Zimmer had some good comments about revisiting the projects that were included in the change of the sustainable yield from 2,400 to 2,760 acre feet per year. I agree, that is critically important and should be done and will be done as part of the updated recommendation for a new sustainable yield. The sustainable yield estimate should be calculated on the currently available infrastructure and shouldn't, from my perspective, be calculated based on some kind of future infrastructure that's yet to be constructed. Specifically, when we're calculating a sustainable yield estimate for a specific year, like we're talking about now, we are tasked with, from the stipulated judgment, calculating a sustainable yield estimate for 2022. And so the infrastructure that's in place now and or, you know, that will be in place at least for the majority of 2022, is the only infrastructure that we should account for as being available when calculating that sustainable yield estimate. Director Cody had a comment about detailed reasoning behind the non-purveyor pumping estimates. That information is available in various forms and components and appendices of the annual report and other documents. My review of those assumptions is they are done with the best available science that we have. Could they be improved? Probably, you know, obviously with metering, but you know, there are certain authorities and limitations to metering. But yeah, revisiting those calculations is something that we can easily do and bring back more detailed information for the BMC's consideration as we move forward with the evaluation of the sustainable yield evaluation and determination of a sustainable yield number for 2022. So I think those were the main comments that I heard.
Okay, excuse me. Thank you, Daniel. I had a question about something Charlie raised about the sustainability in the 80, and that does the basin management plan allows increased penetration? Is that what you said? I'm just trying to get clarity on that.
Yeah. So the definition included in the basin plan for calculating the sustainable yield allows for that calculation to be performed in conditions where seawater is allowed to intrude further inland than the current locations of seawater in the basin, and that's really illustrated by this figure 38 from the basin plan. If you see the BYM 100 and the sustainable yield estimate for seawater intrusion, you'll see that this 250 milligram per liter chloride line has intruded significantly farther than what we have observed to date. You know, we have not seen that intrude to that far in the Pasadena area, and you're seeing it intrude all the way up to the 8th Street well CSD relies upon. You're seeing it intrude past, you know, Rosina and even past the Palisades well here, which is not the current state. And so, yes, the previous calculation was based on a condition that allowed seawater to intrude further than we currently have today within the basin.
Okay, thank you. So do you guys feel like we have direction, or how do you want to proceed at this point?
I'm comfortable that we've got a plan moving forward. We should go ahead and do that. You know, again, transient model. that the estimation of the future response of seawater intrusion that we're just discussing here is essentially a transient effect that we have tried to approximate with a steady state model. We need a transient model to really understand that and have a deeper understanding of it, I guess we'd say. So,
I think we all agree that that's the goal.
I mean, I keep beating on that, Marshall, but there are just so many instances in where we're being asked to make policy decisions based on calculations that could be more sophisticated and could better inform our decision making. So I think there's no disagreement on that, but I feel it important to keep pointing that out. So I think that the setting I like the idea of getting into the framework of the sigma nomenclature of minimum thresholds and measurable objectives. That's helpful to visualize what we're doing as we make management decisions. And so, you know, again, I think that it is a step in the conservative direction to set the sustainable yield in a manner that seawater doesn't intrude. That's going to reduce sustainable yield, absolutely. So I think we move forward on that and just continue working on this. I think we have decent direction for staff to proceed.
Yeah, Bruce, while we've got you here, could you just for one more time explain why existing ag wells are not required to be metered? Because that keeps coming up.
Yeah, there's no ordinance. There's no ordinance to do that. And I think in the development of the basin management plan, it became clear if you want to go measure each and every one of the existing ag wells, there's a huge effort that needs to be undertaken. And the decision was made as we were developing the stipulated judgment. Do you really want to open up the possibility that each and every one of, remind me the number, Marshall, but I think it's 300 individual parties out in the east side of the basin want to become parties to the stipulated judgment in the adjudication? That would create a level of complexity that was huge. And so what it was decided is, so as not to complicate the process and not to impose the burden of legal fees on all those smaller property owners to the east, that if a reasonable estimate of the water extractions in that part of the basin could be made, that for purposes of getting started on balancing this basin and managing it sustainably, we simply make reasonable assumptions. And as Dan indicated, the appendices in various parts of the basin management plan go into considerable detail as to how the water use out in that part of the basin has been estimated. So, you know, if we are to require metering of individual wells in that part of the basin, that requires a county ordinance. Believe me, that's going to be a very big deal for not just the county, but for everybody involved in this discussion. And to me, I'm not opposed to considering it, but there's got to be good reason. And right now, the estimates, I think, have been serving us reasonably well. We have no evidence that they haven't been serving us reasonably well. Sure. And I think that a test of the sensitivity of those assumptions would be appropriate. But at this point, we've got a fairly long and involved conversation to engage before we decide that we really need to go meter those wells.
Yeah, I just wanted you to give an overview on that, Bruce.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment, Director Gibson, if you don't mind. I don't think that we would be asking agronomists or owners of private wells to become parties to the stipulated judgment. I think that we might even short of trying to force someone to meter their well, would we even as the Basin Management Committee think of funding a small project to go and ask people if they would voluntarily accept a Basin Management Committee meter on their wells, a kind of a meter like the ones we've installed at S&T Mutual Water Company that have cellular telemetry that would report back to a database. We could sign non-disclosure agreements, and by we, I mean the Basin Management Committee, to assure them that perhaps we would not give that data to the county or a government agency, that that would be private data, not to be used for any nefarious purpose, but only for the measurement of well of water production information.
Sure. I mean, the voluntary approach is a good one. You know, I would say that even suggesting that there's a voluntary program is going to raise a whole lot of, excuse me, just a second. I've got to call you back. Even suggesting a voluntary program is going to raise a considerable amount of discussion in and of itself. So again, not opposed to considering that, and certainly at the expense of the properly shared of the Basin Management Committee, it's a possibility. But I think we need to do a lot of thinking and discussion within the committee first to understand what the benefits of that are going to be, and you know, do a little thinking, for instance, of if we do have a voluntary program, how many data points do we get out of it that actually are going to be useful? You know, what useful information is that going to provide us? So
yeah, we'll include that as a future discussion item, because I think we're getting too far into the weeds right now. Pardon my...
Marshall, I have a suggestion here that there are several parts of this agenda item. And I guess actually I'm even thinking about the next agenda item that has to do with a suggestion for the budget going forward. We haven't even gotten to. Am I right about that? Should we take these up individually before we decide what direction the committee is giving to staff?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, there are many individual suggestions in this agenda item for, a lot of them, frankly, are about suggestions for policy, which would require a unanimous vote of the committee, for direction to the committee to proceed with.
We're not taking any votes, Charlie. This is just oral direction.
Okay. Well, okay. You said yourself, what's the direction we want to give to?
We're just providing them direction. The formal voting would be when they actually bring this data to us. So right now it's just about the process.
Okay.
So, Daniel, do you think that you have adequate information here?
I guess I would like some more clarification on, you know, so the envisioned process for this is we had a meeting in July where we talked about kind of an overview of how the sustainable yield estimate is calculated, just kind of a background introduction. And then we got direction to review that calculation and the key assumptions and to bring that back to the BMC for consideration and for additional input. So, you know, that's what we're doing here today. We've brought back some staff level recommendations for some potential modifications that could be made to how the sustainable yield is calculated compared to how it was calculated previously. And then what was envisioned for kind of the third meeting would be that then based on that direction, we would come back with actual updated calculations of the sustainable yield estimate for consideration by the BNC in calendar year 2022. We can bring back more than one recommendation based on direction provided from the BNC. If there are multiple sort of sustainable yield calculations that incorporate different assumptions that the BNC would want us to bring back, we can do that. Or we can receive alternate direction. But I guess I would be looking for some direction from the Basin Management Committee to inform what we would bring back to the BMC for consideration for formal approval for the calendar year 2022 sustainable yield estimate.
Yeah, I like your idea of bringing back some alternatives maybe, because I think the one, not the one key thing, but an important item is looking at the 80 or look at the slide you have up there now, looking at either the 100 or the 80, because I'd like to see those two alternatives so we can have a substantive discussion about what those mean. Because right now we're talking in generality, so we really don't know the impacts of the, you know, those two approaches. So I'd like to see some alternatives brought back based on the discussion today.
Marshall, can I add to that, that there's some level of comparison to because we are changing the methodology and approach a little bit. And so I'd like to see how that, I'm anticipating the changes is beneficial, but I just, a little bit of uncertainty there. And I think it would help clarify that if we could add a little bit of comparison in the discussion.
I think that would make sense too also.
But what that sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, in terms of what you're suggesting is a bit of a sensitivity analysis to certain levels of assumption.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, so we could bring back sustainable yield estimates associated with some of the proposed modifications included here today, and then in comparison against to the previously calculated sustainable yield estimates using the previous methodology. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, plus I'd like to see some alternatives, like I said, the 80 versus the 100. So,
well, but Marshall, the 80 versus the 100 is, that's sort of baked into our management objective. I mean, if you want to look at the consequence of, I mean, the sustainable yield is the sustainable yield based on the assumptions we make and the infrastructure in place.
Right.
It is then our choice to manage to a basin yield metric of some safety factor below, and we've chosen 20 for that particular one. Again, using the steady state, the limitations of our current modeling, I think make it difficult, might be the easiest word, to really test a lot of different safety factors. And Dan and Spencer could correct me if I'm wrong, but that choice of 80 is a policy choice,
right?
And you know, based on a physical result that's going to obtain, you know, given the nature of the basin and the infrastructure and the extractions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand, Bruce. All I'm saying is that when we have the substantive discussion, I'd like to see these charts here, you know, updated so we can talk about them. So when we talk about what the safety factor is, whether it's 20, 10, 40, or whatever, I'd just like to be able to have enough data to discuss what safety factor percent we're going to include.
Understood. Again, a policy discussion, the data are the results of different right. model runs, scaling the extractions to the amount that gets us to whether it's 80, 70, 90, whatever.
Right, exactly. I just want to make sure we have that data available for that discussion.
So does that work, Dan?
Yeah, I think I can bring back multiple alternatives and incorporating the BYM 100 or the sustainable yield estimate, and then also what the model would predict where the seawater intrusion front would be when applying at the 20% safety factor of the BYM of 80.
Right. Right.
And then from there, we can kind of interpolate or extrapolate, you know, where a different safety factor would put us.
Right.
No, that's exactly. Yeah, that would be exactly what I'd like to see.
Okay. It sounds good to me.
Okay. The other recommendation was authorization to utilize contingency funds for the level of effort. Can we get some direction on that?
Good by me.
I'm fine with that.
S&T is fine with that.
Golden State's fine too.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. So I guess we'll move on. You still with us, Laura?
I am. The last item is just adjournment.
No.
Oh, no, it's not. 8C, I'm sorry. Dan had it up. I apologize.
No, we have to talk about the extension of the...
Sorry, I got distracted.
Yeah, we have to talk about the governor's extension of the remote teleconferencing of public meetings. So for those of you who aren't aware of this, when the governor signed his order after September 30th, we have to take action to continue authorizing our meetings to be held remotely. So that's what this is.
Yeah, so item 8C, consider authorizing continuation of remote teleconferencing and public meetings based on findings that COVID-19 remains a serious risk to public health and safety. And then also included in this agenda item is just for the BMC's consideration, whether or not we would want to include the use of video at future remote BMC meetings. Currently, we use audio only with the exception of screen sharing, and we don't have videos of BMC staff or directors. So I'll paraphrase this staff report pretty quickly. And if there are detailed technical or legal questions, we can dig into them. But the Brown Act guarantees the public's right to attend and participate in meetings of legislative bodies. As such, the Brown Act requires the meetings of legislative bodies to be open and public. In March of 2020, the governor signed an executive order that allowed local agencies to hold public meetings by suspending many of the Brown Act limitations for teleconferencing, assuming that the local agencies, you know, met requirements that allowed members of the public to participate electronically and followed the proper noticing and accessibility requirements. In June of 2021, the sort of rules that loosened teleconferencing for Brown Act meetings, an executive order was issued that sets for these provisions to expire on September 30th. So that would be tomorrow. However, there has been recent passage of legislation that would allow parties to continue holding teleconferencing meetings while there is a state proclaimed emergency. And there's two bills that I believe are relevant, AB 361 and AB 339. But those bills do require that the public agency issue a declaration or at least pass a resolution stating that it believes it is necessary to continue meeting remotely because of health and safety concerns. And so what we've included in the agenda packet today is a resolution for consideration by the BMC that would allow us to continue to meet remotely because there are state and local officials have imposed recommended measures for social distancing. The legislative body is holding, and the legislative body has already held the meeting and determined by majority vote that such a health and safety risk is present. And so we have the resolution for the BMC's consideration, and then also I just, again, you know, looking for direction from the BMC on whether or not do we want to continue. I guess it'd be good to get input on whether we want to continue holding remote meetings. And if we do, we want to incorporate video into those meetings, and or do we want to consider potentially hybrid meetings moving forward?
Thank you, Daniel. So I think in the short term, I don't want to consider hybrid meetings because I think right now just doing them remotely is the key thing. Whether we do video or not, I quite frankly don't care, but I don't want to do hybrid meetings at this point in time. What do you other guys think here?
I agree. I think it's just the level of complication. So either we go remote or in person,
right?
You know, for the near term, I'm probably slightly more comfortable with remote, but properly, you know, and it's more convenient, but properly masked and vaccinated, I think in person could work as well. The board supervisors is in person.
Excuse me, Marshall, do you need to go to public comment on this item 8C?
Yeah, I will. I just wanted to know if anybody had anything you wanted to discuss first.
Yeah, this is Mark. So Golden State, we aren't authorized to have in-person meetings at this time. So I wouldn't be able to participate in person until our company authorized that.
Okay. All right, so Laura, we can go to public comment now.
If you'd like to make a public comment and you're on your phone, *9. If you're on your computer, please raise your hand. All right, Lindy, you just have to unmute yourself.
Hi, everybody again. I kind of like the Zoom meeting that we have been using for the last year plus. What I don't know is who else is attending, and I find that a little frustrating. I don't know. Is that a hybrid meeting when we actually can see each other? And I'm just questioning. I don't know the technology well enough, but this one only allows us to hear each other and the presentations. So if we could do something that was more similar where we could actually see each other a little bit better and know who's attending, I would be a lot happier with that than this level of Zoom. So my thoughts.
There's no other public comment at this time.
Okay, thank you. So what do you guys want to do?
I'd like to make a motion to accept both of these proposals. One, to adopt a resolution authorizing the BMC to continue teleconferencing, just as it reads here, and two, to provide input to begin video recording of the BMC meetings, which is easy, by the way, with Zoom. So it's very simple and very cost effective to do this with these Zoom meetings.
Yeah.
Marshall, just to clarify, so we're only doing this for the period of 1 month?
Pardon?
The resolution is only going to be active for 1 month.
No. The new order takes effect on September 3rd. So the old thing said that it expired September 30th. The old thing said it expired on the 30th. So this will take effect until the state rescinds it.
We have to renew it every 30 days though, Marshall, or every meeting that we meet.
Okay. I saw the date on here. It only went
oh, really?
10/29. Yeah. So yeah, we'll have to update that every
week. So nominally it's 30 days. Our council has opined that if a board doesn't meet for 45 days, that the action to renew that reso holds over until the next time they're scheduled to meet.
Okay, so, all right, so Charlie has a motion. So we have to do this every single month.
Yep. Put it on consent.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good way to do it. Okay, anybody want to second it? If not, I will.
I'll second it.
Okay. It's a resolution, so we need to take a roll call vote.
Okay. Director Cody?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Zimmer?
Yes.
Chair Ohilski?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Now you were right, Laura. Now we can adjourn.